We are blinded by the delusions that rise from our hollow and rotting social order. It is vain pomposity to believe that humanity can advance while the earth and its native peoples, plants and animals, are enslaved, desecrated, and destroyed. The dream of human origins and destiny, an evolution from monkeys swinging in trees to men in spacesuits lumbering off to other planets, is an adolescent dream of uninitiated men drunk on the power of the cerebral cortex. Unfortunately, the men who maintain this dream are the ones who hold economic, military, and political power today. Whether it be by socio-political revolution, economic disaster, or environmental catastrophes, the overturning of this power is the only hope for the Earth. The change must occur while there is still time to nurture the seed and to prepare ourselves inwardly for the dream of regeneration. That's a quote from Robert Lawler in a brilliant book from 1992 called Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime. That book has become practically my Bible of today because it is a brilliant assessment of the Indigenous people of Australia as the true way of living as human beings on this planet. It's just so extraordinarily powerful that during the 4 years since I haven't been doing On the Brink Radio, two of those years were not only in Australia, but almost all of it was in Western Australia, a region called the Pilbara, which is, according to rock art researcher and epistemologist Robert Bednarik, is the most powerful place on the whole planet in terms of the energies of the Earth and the longest continuous existence of Indigenous people maintaining their sacred connection with the forces of life on this planet. The other 3 months I spent in Eastern Australia, an area called the Northern Rivers, on kind of the lava flow of Wollumbin, Mount Warning, an ancient volcano that's one of the seven major chakras of the rainbow serpent of the Australian continent. Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 357. This is the second in my new series that I resurrected last week in response to Sound Mind and Real Liberty Media. It's an honor to be doing this show again. There's so much to talk about. Initially, just like last week, I was originally going to record it on the solstice, but it ended up being on the 24th in honor of the inception of RIMPAC, the giant naval war game that's just now entering its phase of where they're going to actually go out and blow stuff up, like sink these giant aircraft carriers and test who knows what kinds of weapons, much of which, as Kaitiaki Moana Terry Lilly has told us so much about, it's electromagnetic and microwave in nature. In my blog post, The Electrified Planet, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that is really not on people's radar at all. But what is on our radar, and that I've done the best I possibly can and am trying to do right now, to keep people aware, as sad as it is, of the number of whales and dolphins stranding all over the world, the true ultimate Indigenous people, a true extraterrestrial intelligence, the people of one heart of the ocean. But this show, I was going to record it on the 4th of July, and the show was initially going to be called Happy Interdependence Day. And I was going to do a lot of the show about what the word America actually means and what it doesn't mean, and my perceptions of this concept, this entity, being that I'm in this life originally from here and have been back in one way or another in the what euphemistically is called America for over 2 years. A year of that in Hawaii, which is the reluctant America in the same way that Canada is. And then on the mainland, where I am now, still in Sedona, Arizona, having been in 5 different states, initially North Carolina for a couple of weeks, because Western North Carolina was extraordinarily devastated by an anomalous hurricane in October of year before last. And I felt a spiritual calling to go there, so I went there from the Big Island of Hawaii, where I had just been watching Tutupele erupt. I saw the first 13 of what's now 50 eruptions in this amazing sequence, but I went back to North Carolina trying to bring some good energy and share my art and spiritual upliftment, and the consciousness was so dire. The people were shell-shocked. And the really interesting part was, and this ties in with all my geoterrorism work and with the whales and dolphins and the military-industrial complex awareness, probably 8 out of 10 people I met there said to me, now, keep in mind, this was not me bringing it up. This was other people that I'd never met before. 8 out of 10 people, if not more, they all said something like, Jeff, we all know that this hurricane was not a naturally occurring event. It was so obvious. See, these people, you might say that people from Florida could be kind of used to hurricanes. They might be used to, you know, trees getting blown down and floods and having to evacuate areas and stuff like that. But in Western North Carolina, something like this had never happened before. There was bodies up in trees for days and days and days that people could see. There was houses that live in sort of river valleys where the water had come way up over their house. And it was interesting because the town of Asheville, North Carolina, where it's actually the last place I lived in the USA, Swannanoa, before I went down under in 2000. Apparently, even when I was last there in 1999, Asheville was becoming sort of like, kind of like Sedona is now. It was kind of like a new age Mecca where there was retreats for every possible religious belief and maybe even cults and all kinds of learning centers and yoga centers, and you know, just it was all burgeoning and flourishing. But Asheville, well, it was still a very nice area, very peaceful, very clean, and apparently during the 24 years that I was gone, and still am, Asheville had been billing itself as a disaster-proof environment where stuff like hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, floods couldn't even possibly happen. And so I learned from someone I knew that their friends from Marin County, you know, the extremely high-end area of coastal California north of San Francisco, probably one of the most high-end places in the USA. People there sold out and moved to Asheville, only to have their place devastated by the hurricane. And just as an interesting aside, Sedona, where I am right now, it's kind of like, if you look into it, it's the home of the vortex. That's a word that you really associate. Like, if you look up Sedona, it's known for its vortexes, and you know, I think that there may be something to it. It has to do with the energy of the land, the geotelluric magnetic fields and power spots and sacred sites and that kind of thing. But interestingly, I was in touch with a woman named Paige Bryant, who apparently is credited with coining the term vortex to describe the energy she felt from some of the rocks here in Sedona when she was living here in the 1970s. She had moved to Western North Carolina, and I had been in touch with her. We never actually got to meet, but that was a very interesting circle of connection. The quote from Robert Lawler, actually describes what I see happening in the world right now. Men in spacesuits are lumbering off to space. And the power, political and economic and military power, is held by men drunk on the cerebral cortex and the power of the left hemisphere and technology and money and all the billionaires. And it's interesting also, I guess I'll talk about the word America here for a few minutes, just for entertainment value. But the gist of this show is a continuation of what I talked about in my last show, the confluence of RIMPAC happening right now and the extraordinary number of whale and dolphin strandings everywhere. And we're in this window of time called the Anka window. That's what I call it, E-N-C-K-E. One of two windows of time each year when the Earth is passing through the debris stream of a comet. Not just a comet, a very special comet. But let's talk about what America means for a minute. Living on the road, as I've done really almost the vast majority of my life, ever since I started hitchhiking in 1981, I hitchhiked right at 150,000 miles all over the USA and Canada, 47 states. From 1981 until 1999. And I think because of that, two main effects were that I got to know the USA as a whole place in ways that almost no one else ever does or would or could. Maybe someone like Jack Kerouac back in the 1950s. But it opened my eyes to the reality that the realities of fear and everything that people are so obsessed with that don't really get out in the world, it's a fiction. Because after a few years or a couple of years of hitchhiking, I started to realize that, you know, there's really almost nothing to worry about. You've got to watch out for the occasional somebody who might be drunk or a bit of malfeasance, but that was so few and far between that it almost went off my radar. And also, I can say this retrospectively, that all the hitchhiking I did, where I would be standing essentially in the middle of absolutely nowhere, I mean big time, like in similar to the central desert of Australia, like in the middle of Kansas or Oklahoma on Interstate 40, where you might be 100 miles from the nearest town, or, you know, it's not likely that I would get let off in places like that very often, but I remember one particular day, I think a farmer had to turn down his dirt road, and, you know, but you couldn't see anything but flat prairie and Tornado Alley there in every direction. And I stood there for a few hours. There was absolutely nothing, no human facilities anywhere. And I stood there for a few hours, and I really felt an immensely powerful presence of Native American spirit. And I'm not sure what year this was, but it was around the same time that I was walking out in the hills of Park City, Utah in 1993, and felt the presence of Native American spirit so powerful, almost tangible. And then I came back and sat down at my friend's table, and there was three rocks there. And all of a sudden, I just realized that Native American spirit had just given me the idea and the spiritual authorization to paint on rocks. So that was another one of the things that happened with me, was my connection with Native American spirit. And it wasn't like voluntary. It wasn't any specific tribe or nation or people. It was just kind of a feeling in general of the real-time spiritual existence of the human people that had lived in these lands. Anyway, I might be out on the road in Western Australia. This has happened so many times. And I constantly meet people from all over the world. All over the world, many, many, many countries. You know, you're staying at a backpacker or what they call a hostel here in the USA. You might be have people from 20 different countries staying in the place where you are. You probably get to talk with all of them. And so many, many, many times people would say, "Jeff, so where are you from? Canada?" They'd say it in a way that like they could tell that I was quote unquote American from my accent, but they didn't want to accidentally insult a Canadian by saying that they're American. And so this happened so many times, I started thinking about it. And I'm going, well, look, you know, let's examine this process here. What does it actually mean? And I go like, well, you know, if you're talking about Canadians, I go like, back up a second. So what continent is Canada on? Last time I checked, it's called North America. And the Canadians go, oh, no, no, no. Yes, yes, yes. Canadians, too, I say that they're the reluctant Americans. And then, so now when people say, Jeff, where are you from? I go, like, oh, I'm from southern Canada. Oh, yeah, it's called, quote, unquote, America. But see, but that's not really accurate in the same way that I'm actually not white. And I'm not old. I mean, humans don't get old, and I've never seen a white man. So I started researching what America means. And so it has become synonymous with the USA, but that's not accurate. It's a bit pretentious, to be honest. So I go like, well, look, okay, it comes from the name Amerigo Vespucius, who was an Italian navigator back in the, 1600s, and I think queen of somewhere, Spain or France or something, named these two giant continents after him. And he probably had been there or at least sailed around them, and she had probably never set foot there. But so, you know, that's an honor to have two giant land masses. At that time, they would have been absolutely teeming with indigenous people. Millions and millions and millions. But then I go, but where did that come from? And so I looked it up and I go, like, well, of course. I took 2 years of Latin in college. I mean, excuse me, in high school. And America comes from the Latin word that means love or friendship. Amo, amari, amavi, amatus. That's the different declinations in Latin. Like, it's the same root as amorous, the same root as amigo. So it means a land of love and friendship. And I go, yeah, yeah, right. That's why they killed all the Native Americans. And so another question people say is when they realize that, and oh yeah, just so you know, down under in Australia and New Zealand, possibly in England too, people from the USA are referred to as Yanks. Y-A-N-K-S, like Yankee, like a Yankee Doodle Dandy. And so, and it's not derogatory. The Yanks, it's like the Brits, the Yanks, the Poms, the Kiwis, the Aussies. It's not derogatory at all. So I go like, well, look, where did that come from? And I go like, okay, well, was it French? Les Yankees? You know, you think of Yankee Doodle Dandy from the Revolutionary War. You've got the Yanks and the Confederates and the Civil War. And once I was talking with my friend Robert Hogenbaum, who I've interviewed on my On the Brink show many years ago, brilliant scholarly Dutch friend of mine who lives in Sydney. He said, Jeff, back in the 1600s, there was this man who excelled at his ability to help oppressed people, whether they were oppressed by a king or a military regime or a government. He helped these people to organize so that they could then rebel and escape and free themselves from the tyranny of these overlords or oligarchs. And his name was Jan Kees, J-A-N-K Yonkees, the Yonkees. And I'm like, wow, how cool. And yes, in case you're interested, this is in fact Googleable. And so I don't know if the Yonkees were a name that they took themselves or if it was given to them by the people that they escaped from. Oh, look, the Yonkees are escaping. They're rebelling. They're acting up. So anyway, but I thought that that's pretty cool. And the American accent. Like, I was living in Brisbane in one of my first years in Australia. And my friend Nathan, very classic young Aussie man. Oh, he was a college student. He spent hundreds of dollars to put a turbocharger on the motor of his Datsun just to make it loud. It's called hooning. Hooning, H-O-O-N, when you want to have a loud motor. Anyway, after he got to know me, he says, Jeff, you have a hell accent, which to him, it means good. And so his same circle of friends, if something was really super cool, it was filth. You know, so I was in Maui. This would have been March of 2024 when I first came from Australia. And the evil ogre mother of my friend I was staying with, that's not much of an exaggeration at all. One day, she snarled at me. She snarled with venom coming out. And she said, Jeff, why do you have such an annoying Australian accent? And unbeknownst to her, that was an extraordinarily high compliment. I go like, oh my God, what? Thank you. Ah, I love that. By the way, what is it that I'm saying? And she goes, Australia. And I go like, well, how do I say it? She goes, Australia. I mean, like, g'day, mate, you're bloody joking. Kaba. So anyway, I could do a whole On the Brink show just about what America, quote unquote, means with, these days I put a, I spell it with a K, AmericaTM Incorporated, Proprietary Limited Incorporated. So anyway, I could also do a show on the different accents that I experience with people speaking English, which has to be one of the most complex and anonymous symbolic languages of the modern world. And for better or worse, and by default, it truly is the most universal of human languages. I think I talked about this before. One of the central differences between Crown English, as spoken in Australia, New Zealand, and England, is the pronunciation of the letter R. R. Hi, how are you? And there's a branch of phonetics called rhoticity. R-H-O-T-I-C-I-T-Y. Rhoticity deals with the pronunciation of the letter R. It's after the Greek letter rho, R-H-O. If you watch what your mouth does when you say R, you kind of open your mouth and you go ah, like you're opening your mouth for the doctor, ah, and then you go R, like your roar. What sound does the lion make? And so it's really two different moves, R. But people that speak Crown English have grown up their whole lives not making that second move. They call it ah. How are ya? And at the end of a word, like what the holiday we call Easter, in Australia it's Easter. So it's very interesting. I try to get people down under to say it, and I go like, and they go, ah. It's hard for them to bring their jaw around to make the run. I go like, what sound does the lion make? Roar. roar. I guess a few more comments on being in the USA. America, in terms of continents, is actually one giant landmass, two major continents connected by Central America, which has a narrow little neck. I guess it's severed by the Panama Canal, but it consists of about 35 different countries. And when I was living in Chile in 2006, the people there go, they said, "Jeff, we too are American." And I'm like, "But of course, I say that all the time." You know, so I've tried to, even before I left the States, and in 2000 when I boarded Air New Zealand to fly to Auckland, I thought I was going to be gone a few months. I had no earthly idea what lay ahead for me. And I never left the USA to be leaving. I just went on a big adventure. It just keeps going. I mean, the big adventure eventually has brought me back here for a while on a reconnaissance mission. And as difficult and challenging as it was in the beginning for me to be back in this country, I'll go into that in a second. Especially having come here to Sedona and the beautiful situation that I've got for a few weeks and being able to reconnect with Native American spirit in what might be the equivalent, the North American equivalent of the Pilbara, the most powerful earth energy place on the whole continent and probably one of the main ones of the whole world. The Four Corners area here in an area called Monument Valley. It's a whole region where, on the topographical maps created since the 1800s, and I still don't know how they came up with this. Why did they put, there's a cross. The state boundaries of Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, where they all meet, is right at the Four Corners area, where the Hopi call the navel of the earth, a major power spot for the whole planet. So that's something I'm going to look into. Whoever those cartographers were that drew that map were trying to pinpoint something, but it's not a spot, it's a region. And the Hopis are in it. As they say down under, it was a bit of a shocker when I came to Maui after having been in Australia for four consecutive years. And for the almost most of the last two in Western Australia, and then 3 months up east in the area where I first spent time in Australia. Extraordinarily powerful, extraordinary. So when I went to Maui, it was a shocker when my friend took me to the grocery store and I looked at the price on a bottle of grape juice. And I went like, "Oh my God, you have to be a millionaire to live here." And my friends go, "Yeah, but Jeff, this is the cheapest place." And I'm like, "What?" And so anyway, I remember my friend took me to an outdoor organic market. And I looked at a beautiful, big, red, ripe, juicy tomato about... it took up most of my hand. $4.50 for one tomato. And that blew my mind. Because even though Australia has gained a reputation for becoming quite expensive, even by European standards in recent years, and of course a lot of it is, and the more remote you are, the more expensive it is, especially like in Western Australia. And their excuse is the freight. But so, interestingly, I was in a health food store here in Sedona 2 weeks ago and I saw a very similar, beautiful, red, ripe, juicy, organic tomato. And it cost even more. So, this is one of the things that I've noticed is When I first came to the States, I'd been in Hawaii a couple of times, which is the reluctant USA. And there, especially this last time when I went to Maui, it's beautiful. But the thing that really jumped out at me was the sense of entitlement that so many of the people seem to have. And maybe it's just because, I mean, I don't know if Maui has any poor neighborhoods. I kind of doubt it. But where I was, where I was lucky to be, just happened to be one of the most high-end parts of Maui. I mean, not the super, super, super Mark Zuckerberg kind of people, but still people that were millionaires with their houses way up. This was like two-thirds of the way up. Haleakala, this beautiful volcano. The first volcano I ever met in 1998, before I went down under. So this sense of entitlement seemed to be ubiquitous. And the weirdness of the money from this country. Like in Australia and New Zealand, every bill is a different shape and color. It's quite... And it won't fold. It's made of plastic and it's got a little clear window. And the money here is all the same. And plus, it just seemed ridiculously stupid to use pennies. They haven't... I don't know if they've had 1 cent coins down under for 50 years. But it just seems so stupid when you pay for something with cash and you end up with a pocket full of metal. And the 1 cent thing. And it's just, it's ridiculous. And so this is all stuff I've kind of got used to. And I have to say that I've been very well taken care of in my visit to the USA. I've had really nice places to stay. In general, at times I've had to pay extraordinarily extortion level rates to have a place to stay. I've had to endure extraordinary bullshit from people. But in general, I've been very well taken care of, and it seems to be getting better and better as time goes on. And I would say, right now, largely thanks to this beautiful woman who's letting me caretake her Airbnb house while she's away on extremely important family business. For me to have this opportunity of having a house during the slow time of the summer with almost no Airbnb guests at all, I've got the whole house to myself for days and days and days at a time. And it's kind of like when I was house-sitting in Darwin during COVID, I would have that house for weeks and weeks and weeks. And in the same way that COVID was actually, to me personally, was actually a blessing, this time here in Sedona is a similar gift. As a segue back into the real important content of this show, there's quite a few helicopters today that the bushfire 7 miles to the north has, they're saying it's about 35% contained, but there's a lot of, it's been almost constant helicopters and planes in the air this morning. In fact, there's two right now. I guess I'll give a very, very brief synopsis of the history of this country. The Yankees left England and became the colonists in North America and had initially a very harmonious relationship with the Native Americans. In fact, without that, they would have never survived. And then everything went pear-shaped not too long after. But another one of the things people ask me all the time I'll be on the road in Western Australia. They'll go like, Jeff, so what's up with your president? And I think they're referring to Trump. But I go like, you mean Thomas Jefferson? The last one I liked, I think he died in like 1882 or something like that. And they'll go, Jeff, so what's up with your country? And I go like, you mean the Southern Canada? The land that belongs to the Native Americans? I think they should give it all back. Anyway, Thomas Jefferson, even though he had slaves and blah, 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 everything's much more complex when you start looking into it, I still think he was a very highly intelligent, educated, true statesman. And he was responsible for, and not solely, but probably largely, as well as Benjamin Franklin and some of the other people that wrote the Constitution. And this is also another big difference that Robert Lawler points out in his book, Voices of the First Day. I don't have the quote right in front of me, but he points out that in the USA, the founding fathers embraced the Native Americans that were here at that time, specifically the Iroquois Native Americans of New York and up in that area, New England. Thomas Jefferson, I don't know the details of his personal relationships, but apparently it was closely knit, and he was so impressed with they had a confederacy of their different Native American nations that was already in existence when the colonists came from England. So he adopted a lot of their basic principles of what a social organization should be like, including, as I understand it, one of the most important ones. It was called the seventh generation, a belief or an imperative that every decision that's made at any level, no matter how important or insignificant, you should take into consideration the implications of this decision-making for not tomorrow, not next week, not next year, not your kids, but seven generations down the road, which is extraordinarily foresightful and so completely opposite of the mentality of now. And as a footnote here, this would be a footnote in when I'm writing my blog post about this, when I was researching watching a documentary about Rachel Carson. There was an interview with Arnold Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N-N, a genetic toxicologist that was a top-ranking health official for the Kennedy administration. And he said that if we really want to truly understand the genetic effects of chemical and radiological mutagens, like plutonium, strontium-90, DDT, atrazine, all the stuff that Rachel Carson talked about, we had to study 25 generations of people. We who exist now are only the third generation of people to exist since all this stuff came into being after World War II. So what does that tell us? So anyway, Thomas Jefferson and these guys, they created the Constitution and the Republic, the Democratic Republic of the United States of America, E Pluribus Unum and all that stuff. Sounded good on paper. Don't know if it was ever a true democracy or not. That was kind of a Greek ideal. But I remember one of the most important things I read of him, I think it was from 1835, Thomas Jefferson warned that if the bankers ever got control of the USA, we'd be completely fucked. And he was right. He could see it coming then. And so, that's what I think has happened. There's always been, you know, you can call it secret societies, you can call it the international banking cartel. It's kind of been there all along. You can call it the Illuminati, whatever, you know, I don't necessarily buy into all this stuff, but I mean, but who knows? But it's fairly reasonably documentable historically that there has been a cadre of vested interests in this country that were probably based in Europe that have been sort of manipulating things behind the scenes all along. And I think that some of these same interests are who actually financed and made possible the Third Reich, Hitler, Nazi Germany, and all that stuff. Because of their covert and not so covert backing, Nazi Germany had become the world's foremost industrial and military power. They were doing stuff that was like at science fiction level in terms of the creation of weapons. And they thought they were even on the verge of getting the atomic bomb. They had the V2 rocket. All this stuff. And so I think that after World War II, there was this thing called Operation Paperclip, where all the highly valued Nazi scientists and strategists and military thinkers and researchers and engineers and scientists, and a lot of them were psychiatrists, they were divvied up and imported into the USA and Russia. And I think that we're seeing the implications of that all through the world of today. Like, how many times have you looked at what was happening during COVID and it made you think of Nazi Germany? Or how many times have you looked around in the world of today, that's what's happening with Gaza and Palestine, and thought of Nazi Germany? How many times have you heard hate speech and stuff about white supremacy veiled in different terms, spoken by people like Pauline Hanson, the kind of the female Adolf Hitler of Australia right now? That kind of stuff. It's so clear. And from what I've read, the people of Nazi Germany, they thought it was the time of their lives. They had no idea, or they didn't want to know what was really going on. They'd see the cattle cars being loaded up with children. Oh, they're going to kindergarten. Or they'd see the big billowing smoke from the different in the distance. Oh yeah, that's the Auschwitz tire factory. Which it was. But that's not all it was. So denial. There's a brilliant movie called Judgment at Nuremberg. And I created a piece of music called I Am Aware. That's got some dialogue from that, along with Jimi Hendrix playing the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, slowed down and backwards. Tells the whole story. It's about denial. So I think that in some ways, the USA, even though all the military-industrial complex, it's not located in any certain country. It's not even located in any certain corporations or governments. It's all this sort of interlocked network of, it's like a planetary juggernaut. That's what we have in the world of today. And the USA is sort of like the, I don't know if you'd call it the brain of the planetary mega machine, but in some ways it's like it's its biggest organ. I don't know what organ there would be that would correspond. Would it be the penis of the planetary mega machine? Or would it be its biceps? Or its tongue? I don't know. My brain's doing this right on its own right now. I've never thought to make that comparison before. But it is like a giant. It's got many tentacles going everywhere. But now we're getting back to the what this show's really about. The effects of the global military-industrial apparatus on life as we know it on the Earth, which is the only planet we know that has life. Astronomer Carl Sagan, who I got to meet once and for 5 minutes in 1992, he was one of my favorite scientific minds, not only because he was a spokesperson for rational thinking and the wisdom of realizing that we've created all our most advanced technologies as weapons aimed at ourselves on a planet that's, regardless of our knowledge or beliefs about space and the cosmos, we don't know any other world that has life. Nowhere. We can speculate, we can hope and dream, we can think there might be aliens coming to rescue us or abduct us, but it's all kind of like imaginary. We don't know any other planet that has life. And it seems like we're doing our best to wage war on this life. And we have the audacity to call ourselves Homo sapiens, man the wise. And so to me, that's kind of like a megalomania. And again, I'm touching on themes that I wrote about extensively in my article from 2012 called "We Are Not Alone Yet, How We're Waging War on a True Extraterrestrial Intelligence." So now we've come full circle back to why I was talking about the astronomical number of whale and dolphin strandings, because they are the true people of this planet. They're not human people, but as I've told someone the other day, in 2014, I was able to interview Gavi Duncan. He's a Darkinjong traditional owner, which is an indigenous First Nation people from southern Queensland. And he said, "Jeff, our people believe that a long, long, long time ago, that the whales taught our ancestors how to become people." And I go like, "Dude, wow." I was kind of thinking that myself, but he verified that that's their ancient belief. So I call them the ultimate indigenous people. And it's kind of like with the extraordinary amount of time I've just had in Australia and in Western Australia, it's really changed me a lot. It's bringing me back to, I think, what it really means to live as a human being on this planet. That's why, like now, during my time in Sedona, and whenever I'm able to, which the universe has actually given me quite a lot of time like this, where I'm able to be by myself for weeks at a time, to have beautiful, nice weather, to not even have to wear clothes if I don't want to be able to sit and be in touch with plants maybe that I'm growing, the birds and all the animals, with water, the clouds, with the stars, with the sun and the moon. And where I am, it's quite extraordinary. Right now, I've got my own little, it's a fountain, and sure, it's got public water circulating in it, but it's the little gurgling sound. And the bubbles, I become enraptured with bubbles, photographing them and watching how they move and transform. But I call this my bubble oracle. It's kind of like how, after I was guided back in 2023, I was living at the Oski Roadhouse in the Pilbara near Karajini National Park. And I had been guided by four different Aboriginal people to find a sacred waterhole in a gorge that's part of Karajini, but outside the park, this gorge continues. And there's several waterholes there if you have explicit directions on how to find them. And I was told that there was this one where they said the rainbow serpent lived. And I go, well, so is it okay for me to visit there? And my friend goes, well, yeah. I'll tell you what you're supposed to say when you go there. You're greeting the rainbow serpent and letting him or her know that you're there and asking permission to come. And so I did that, and I got in this beautiful green water, and it was super hot that day, but this water was really nice and cool, and I could not get out. It was like I stayed in for an hour, and it was kind of like anywhere there was water in the galaxy, I was in touch with it from being in that water hole. I called it a radio telescope of the dream time. So I've come to think now that any body of water is so powerful and magical that it might have abilities like that, or capacities, or that these kind of capacities might be perceived or imbued upon it. Again, this is the kind of science fiction writer in my brain. But it's very, very, very powerful. So anyway, right now, the biggest naval war game in the world, which is the equivalent, there would be wars that are fought that probably do less damage than this. Although it's like a giant sporting event. I see footage of people standing there up on the deck of these battleships, and they're watching all these people with uniforms on, and they're watching all the boats go, and they're going to sink. Imagine just sinking two battleships just in the ocean. You're going to blow it up and sink it. I mean, what the fuck? Why can't you just park it somewhere and take the metal apart and recycle it? No. It's part of the spectacle of destroying stuff. And it's like a sport with dire consequences for life on Earth. And so this is all going on now. This week is when all the blow-up stuff is going to happen. And I need to do a bit more research and talk with my friend Terry Lilly about exactly what's going on. But so much of it is the testing of these drone undersea weapons that use microwaves and thousands of sensors. It's a complete weaponization of the entire ocean. And another thing that I started looking into is how all rocket launching facilities that I know of are located on the coast of wherever. And they do that so that the rocket launches can go and their boosters can just drop in the ocean, because there's nobody there. The ocean is terra nullius, or aqua nullius. So I started looking into, I already knew this from before, in 2022 there was a double stranding of 250 pilot whales on the Chatham Islands, which is a few hundred k's east of New Zealand, and the next day another 250. And a few hours before that first stranding, a rocket lab launch, and they give them these stupid sounding names, like this launch was called We Will Never Desert You. That launch took place a few hours before this stranding. And I went like, well, look, what if that booster dropping in terrified these pilot whales and they headed to the nearest land to try to get their ears out of the water? So I mapped out and I saw the trajectory of that flight. And indeed, it went straight out over following the Chatham Rise, which is exactly where high concentrations of pilot whales are usually found, because that's where they feed. They go down in these depths and get their squid. So, in researching that this past week, I found some new information that this particular launch, not only did the booster drop into the ocean, the second stage actually failed. The second stage separated, but its rocket motors did not ignite. So the whole second stage, including the satellite or payload, whatever it was they were launching, it crashed into the ocean too. So there would have been a double whammy of two different things crashing into the ocean that I think generated two strandings of pilot whales within hours. We can't prove anything like this. So what I've been trying to do, among many other things, is communicate with Rocket Lab. And if I'm able to take the time, I can look on their websites and look at their trajectory of every one of their almost 90 rocket launches that have happened. But what would be really cool is if I could get the GPS coordinates of where all these boosters dropped in, and to just see a map. It would be an arc going out from the Mahia Peninsula. And to see how this correlates with where pilot whales are often seen. But then, you know, if you pull back and you watch how much stuff we're putting into space, and how much of it falls back to Earth, and how much of it stays in space, and how much of that eventually falls back, and how we're clogging up the whole low Earth orbit sphere with probably now hundreds of thousands of satellites. Some of these photos I've shared in the past few days that show, there was one photo that was from, I think he was shooting from the Atacama Desert in Chile, but it was an exposure over 80 minutes. And even though his camera ran for a total of 10 minutes, over a span of 80 minutes, it showed 338 satellite streaks. And he said if the camera had run for the whole 80 minutes, it probably would have showed over 1,000. So to see 1,000 satellite streaks in not much more than an hour, I mean, what is that telling us about what's happening in the skies? And we've got rocket debris washing up. Last year we had SpaceX debris that had the name on it that crashed down on beaches near where sea turtles were nesting in Mexico. We had weird-looking spheres that washed up on Queensland beaches just a few days ago that people think was from a Chinese rocket. A big part of my work has been and is to quantify and document the ways in which our species is waging war on life, with the implication that we might be able to do something about it. And the reason that my perspective is as it is because of the degree of depth that I've gone to and the time I've taken to research exactly how much of all the stuff there is. I mean, not many people have done that. My quantification of the global nuclear scenario alone, I don't know anybody else that's done anything like that.